This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Let's imagine we're in a large room in a converted warehouse, perhaps, crammed with reference books, charts, maps, and a small army of leading experts who in the next hour's podcast can tell us everything we might want to know about the burning issues of the day. This week, the British Constitution. And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy some of our other episodes, including, given the news on falling vaccine uptakes, the one on the cases for and against compulsory vaccination. You can find them all on BBC Sounds. On Tuesday, within hours of the spider-brooch Lady Hale announcing the Supreme Court's landmark decision on the prorogation of Parliament, a company had produced and completely sold out of spider motif T-shirts. 4 million viewers had apparently watched the live broadcasting of her statement, which outlined constitutional principles going back centuries. Most of them will have realised that this was all very important, and many will have wondered where it left us in terms of some really big questions. How should we be governed, and does our constitution still work? So in this week's extended programme, I want to understand whether Britain's constitution needs overhauling, and if so, how would anyone go about doing it? Step inside the briefing room to find out. There's no point in hanging around. We'll start with the basics. What exactly is a constitution and why should I care about it? I'm joined in the briefing room by Alison Young, Professor of Public Law at the University of Cambridge. Alison Young, what is a constitution?
It's a very good question. There's lots of different ways of looking at it, which is why we get lots of different confusing answers. So often when you go and say to somebody, what is a constitution, they can wander off into a library, they can pick a volume off the shelf, and it will say, here is the US Constitution, for example. So you have all the provisions in there that are written down. And you can't do that in the UK. It can be a bit harder to explain what it is. So we often just describe it by saying, well, it's the rules that help us to govern different institutions of government. So we talk about Parliament that makes laws. We talk about the courts, the judiciary that go away and interpret and apply the laws. And we talk about the government and the executive who are there to administer the laws. And the Constitution says who they are, what their powers are, and how they interact with each other and how they interact with individuals. But there's also a deeper sense to constitution. And that's when we take a step back and say, well, we're talking about these governmental institutions. They have lots of power. So we need to make sure that their actions are legitimate. So often when we're talking about things being constitutional or unconstitutional, we're saying this is or is not a legitimate exercise of power. And in the UK, all of those three things sort of get merged because we can't go away and say, here is a nice big document that tells us what all the rules are.
So if I were to ask you why it matters, I mean, it just kind of chunters along without me having to worry about it. Why should I be concerned about it?
You should be concerned about it because this is governing power. And so if you are living in a particular society, you have institutions in power who are making rules and you have to abide by those rules. And if you don't abide by those rules, then it's legitimate for the society to punish you for breaking those rules. So it's important for everybody to understand how we make these rules, how we interpret them, how we apply them, because they matter to everybody in everyday life.
What are the key things I should look for in a constitution that would tell me whether a constitution was, say, good or bad?
So you're looking for, first off, a constitution that has good principles and values in it, that are making sure we have legitimate exercises of authority. So you'll have lots of people talk about we want democratic decision making, and we mean we want to have institutions that are accountable to the people. And we have a system of representative democracy, and we want individuals in MPs, in Parliament, to be able to be informed, to discuss things and to deliberate so we get the right rules that are being made. You'll also want to look for things like judicial independence. We want a judiciary that can look at the laws, apply them independently, and make sure they're administered in a fair way. So we often look at this and say, well, we want something we call the rule of law. We want to make sure we have rules that are clear and precise that can guide how we act, and that these rules are implemented legitimately as well. You'll also want to discuss and look at things like human rights. So do we want to have human rights being protected to make sure that people's individual liberties are protected from intrusion? So we're looking for these values, but also we're looking for rules that are clear, that are easy to apply, and that are understandable. So if we know what the rules are, then we can know institutions can abide by them.
To what extent does a constitution protect the citizen from the ruler?
Well, that, in a sense, that's the whole point. The aim is to make sure you have a constitution that is there, that has these principles to make sure individuals are protected in this way, which is why we talk about wanting to have protections of human rights. It's why we talk about wanting to have the rule of law, that those institutions who are governing us are governed by the law.
Now, I have to make a confession here. I come from a background in which we thought that the Soviet Union was a good place when I was a child. And I learned subsequently that they had a fabulous constitution created in 1936 or 7, I think it was.
They did
under
indeed.
Under Stalin, which embodied all these things.
Absolutely.
How can you have a really fabulous constitution and a really rubbish government?
Good question. I think it's because it's recognising that you can have all the great rules that you want, but unless you're actually abiding by the principles of what they're there for and you have institutions that are abiding by them, then it doesn't really work. So yes, you can have good rules, but you have to have individuals who are also guided by those principles and want to act and implement them properly.
So let's take the independence of the judiciary. Do you mean that if, say, the judiciary decided, for whatever reason, that it was going to do pretty much what politicians asked it to do, you might have a formal position of independence, but you'd actually have a corrupt system?
Absolutely. And that's a very, very good example. That so we often cite that when we look at things like the Soviet Union, also when you go away and analyse what goes on in China, you look carefully to say, well, is there really independence there, or are they just doing what people in power want them to do?
So where can I find our constitution?
Okay. Well, we do have aspects of the constitution in lots of different sources. So you can go away and find pieces of legislation. So you've probably heard people at the moment talk a lot about something called the Fixed Term Parliaments Act 2011. And this is a piece of legislation which governs when you can have a general election. So we've had lots of arguments about whether you can have votes of no confidence or not, because you have to have that system now to go through a process of a general election. So that's a piece of legislation that tells us how we govern. We also have things like the Human Rights Act 1998, which incorporates human rights into the UK. You also have to go away and look at common law. So these are the rules that the courts develop. So if you've been listening to the recent prorogation case, you'd have heard Lady Hale say, well, we have statutes, but we also have common law. And she drew on common law principles of parliamentary sovereignty and parliamentary accountability.
What's the difference between statutes and common law?
Okay, it's how they're enacted, so how they're created. So when we go away and look at statutes, they're enacted by Parliament. So a statute in the UK has to be passed by the House of Commons, the House of Lords, and get the Royal Assent of the Queen. Whereas common law are rules and principles that have been decided by the courts. So you go to court, the court decides a case, and in doing so, it creates these principles of the common law. And when courts decide cases, they look back to previous cases, they look at the case in front of them, they look for similarities, they look for differences, and they're drawing on these principles that come through the case law, and that's the common law.
So to find our constitution, you'd have to go through all the statutes and you'd have to go through a lot of common law to find out where it was.
You would, and you'd still not be finished, because as well as having legislation and common law, we have these things called conventions. Conventions are essentially rules that are not enforced by the court, so they're non-binding rules and practices. So one common example that people might know of is the Sewell Convention, which the Sewell Convention, that's right. And this is an interesting convention because it emerged out of discussions between the Westminster government and the devolved governments. And so it's also an agreement between the governments as well as a convention. And this convention says that the Westminster Parliament will not normally legislate on a devolved area of power or an area that will alter the devolved areas of powers without getting the consent of the devolved legislatures. And you can't go to court and say, oh my goodness, you've enacted this without our consent, because it's a convention. So the court can't enforce it. The aim is that it will be enforced politically. And there are political restrictions, in a sense, so that you will not break the convention.
I don't understand why that's actually a part of a constitution at all, then. Because anybody can at any stage just say, we're not going to do it.
It's like, and this is where it raises an interesting question. So it is part of the constitution descriptively, because it describes what goes on. And a lot of the conventions are enforced. So, for example, the Queen is not meant to refuse royal assent to legislation unless advised by a minister to do so. And that's a convention that has been enforced for a very long time. And it would be very, very unusual for the monarch to break that particular convention. It would be practically unheard of. So they do guide. The difficulty is, how effective is the mechanism to hold people to account? And that's when we start to think, well, are these conventions actually ensuring accountability? So I mentioned the Sewell Convention. But if you talked to lots of people in Scotland, if you talked to the Scottish government, they would be very concerned about the Sewell Convention because, for example, the European Union Withdrawal Act 2018, the act that tries to ensure that once we leave the European Union, we have a smooth transition. Those provisions do have an impact on devolved powers, but they were enacted without the consent of Scotland.
So why don't we write it all down?
It's not as simple as just gathering all together and writing it all down. So we've spotted that when you talked about conventions. We discussed, are they really rules? How do we know what they are? They can be quite hard to pin down. So you have to think very carefully about the content you want to put in. So even if you just try to gather everything together and write it down, you'd be deliberating about what the content of these rules are. And that could be quite complicated. So it would take a lot of time. So the question is, do we really have the time to sit down and do this and write them all down? You could also argue, well, yes, it's not in one document, but lots of things are becoming written down. It's a kind of, it's work, so we might as well just carry on with it. But the more we start to question whether it's actually working effectively, the more pressure there's going to be to write it all down.
Alison Young. If there's one thing people tend to know about Britain's constitution, it is that it's unwritten, which saves them the bother of having to read it. But how did it end up that way? To help me understand the history behind this, I'm joined now by Lord Norton of Louth, Professor of Government at the University of Hull. Philip Norton, if I want to understand the British Constitution, where should I begin in history?
Well, there's no one point. That's the nature of our constitution. It's grown up over time. I mean, you can go back basically to when a monarchy developed in this country, back to, say, the 11th century, when you got a coronation oath where the king promised to forbid rapine and injustice to men of all conditions and to be merciful in all judgments. So really from its origins, when we've got, you know, an all-powerful king, nonetheless agreeing to be constrained in the way they exercised rule in the country. So over time, that's then evolved. It developed in the 13th century. That acquired functions of having to give assent for raising money, for raising supply, in time then for legislating, joining with a king in making law, and developing a capacity for scrutinising the king's ministers, what they were doing, or the administration. So scrutiny of the executive developed as a parliamentary function. So it's really developed over time, the relationship between the executive, which was initially the monarch, and then in more recent centuries, the monarch's ministers formed as a government, and the legislature, that is parliament, and the king's courts, that then became an independent entity. So ended up with the distinct elements of the executive, the legislature, and the courts.
But still, pretty much with the king in charge of everything and so on. So all these things happened according to whether the king wanted them. And if it was convenient for the king for them to be there, then they were. And if it was inconvenient, he might get rid of them. Is that essentially how it was?
There were periods when Parliament didn't meet, but it became more important because the king was dependent on Parliament. So it's difficult to govern without Parliament because you needed its consent, and that was the whole point of the Glorious Revolution of 1688-1689, which was to forbid the king from making law without the assent of Parliament. But you're quite right in the point that policy making, the fount of policy, still rested with the executive, with the king. So Parliament responded to what the king was bringing forward, and that's always been the case really in our history, of looking to the crown to come up with policy. But then Parliament insisted that it had to give assent to what the king wanted to legislate for, and so Parliament was important. The king couldn't enact legislation without Parliament, but the king was in the driving seat.
So when that developed, the Prime Minister essentially became the king.
What developed in the 18th century, Sir Robert Walpole, generally regarded as our first Prime Minister and indeed the longest serving, served the king because he could control Parliament, but the fact of how he can control Parliament, the king's confidence was important as well. So, yes, government developed, and really what we saw in the 19th century with the growth of a mass franchise, a large electorate, the growth of organised political parties, so they came to dominate elections, was, yes, the transfer of power, if you like, from the monarch to the monarch's ministers. And so it's done in the name of the crown, but it's done by the monarch's ministers who now form the government and form that government through elections to the House of Commons.
So the ministers were appointed by the king, the Prime Minister was appointed by the king to do and propose things, and Parliament was there in order to say yes or no, you can or you can't, but not to actually propose to do anything itself.
Correct. It could call government to account. And in the 19th century, you got the development of collective responsibility, because in the 18th century, when Robert Walpole was first Prime Minister, there wasn't any collective responsibility and the king chose who the ministers would be. So what you got in the 19th century was our current Westminster form of government, where you had one body, essentially the party in government, responsible for public policy, acting in the name of the crown, but the government elected through the House of Commons, coming forward with policy, standing before the House of Commons as a collective entity, hence the doctrine of collective responsibility, and then facing electors at the next election to be held account for what it had done. So ministers remained accountable formally to the crown, but politically to electors. So that's really how the system developed in the 19th century.
But wasn't there a contradiction then built in right from the beginning, which is that you're either accountable to the crown or you're accountable to Parliament? You can't really be accountable to both.
Well, you answer to formally to the monarch for the policy you're devising, but you're operating in the name of the crown in bringing forward that policy. Of course, the crown then developed from the 19th century onwards as detached from politics and came to occupy that role as representing being above politics. And so conventions developed to protect the monarch from political engagement. And so the political work was done by the government in the name of the monarch.
Well, why do we have a monarch then if he or she just does what the Prime Minister says?
Well, there's a difference between the formality and, if you like, the political reality. And there's a certain value in retaining that formality, because there's an element of a nuclear option. So there are certain formal powers that reside in the Crown which are not exercised, but they could be. Now, formally, the monarch could veto a piece of legislation, but that's not happened since Queen Anne with the Scottish Militia Bill, which instituted in 1707.
So there's a power formally could be exercised by the monarch and upheld by the courts that the monarch should do it, which hasn't actually anybody wanted to exercise or has exercised for 320 years.
Correct. So it's the nuclear option. It could be. So there's always that constraint that if you somehow the government behaves so irrationally that it was necessary. But the assumption is it won't, because the government is itself constrained politically by the fact it's answerable to electors. So it does operate within certain rational boundaries anyway.
If I were, 14-year-old doing my British Constitution GCSE, and I ask you, well, so who does history say is in charge then? What do you say?
Well, I think that's the beauty of our system, because you don't have one person that's deciding it all. There's that element of accountability in the system. There's the formal element to the Crown, but the political accountability through elections. So the people choose one body that will be formed, the government, but then it's accountable to them as well as to the Crown. So that, I think, is one of the benefits of the system. You don't have somebody who is all-powerful, that power is actually dispersed rather than wholly concentrated.
Now, at the very least, this picture is confusing. There's no two ways about it. It's confusing.
It's become confusing.
Well, if you have things that could have been done since 1707 but nobody ever chooses to do, it sort of argues that you're acting in a rather kind of archaic way because it suited you up until now. And at some point or other, it was always going to kind of become tricky. I mean, so the question I was going to ask was, have there been moments when people have said, actually, we've arrived at a really difficult situation, we ought to change things?
Well, you could argue you're probably in that situation now. You've not really had it on any significant scale much in the past century or so. The closest and the parallel with the present time is early in the 20th century, because towards the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, the core issue in British politics, the divisive issue, if you like, the toxic issue, was Irish Home Rule. And now, since the Second World War, here it's been European integration that's really divided people and caused tensions within the system. And the problem is that can lead to constitutional change, which isn't decided on its own merits, but is a reaction to events and people are utilising it to achieve their own political goals. So in the early 20th century, for example, you had reform of the House of Lords, you had the 9/11 Parliament Act. And much of the debate around that wasn't about the merits of a second chamber and the relationship to the first. It was over Irish Home Rule, because opponents wanted to use the House of Lords to block it. Those who wanted Irish Home Rule wanted to limit the power of the Lords. So there is the danger when political issues become so dominant, divisive, that people start to look to change in the constitution to get the result they want, that they think they can't get through existing means.
Lord Norton. Which brings us back to the now. After the Supreme Court decision, there were all kinds of noises, not least in government, that changes should be made to bits of the Constitution. So I want to know, is our Constitution in trouble? Are there other models out there that might be useful for us to follow? And should we have a written one, like almost everyone else? For the rest of the programme, we'll consider these questions and more and turn the briefing room into a constitutional convention, the Aronovich Commission, to work out the best way forward. To help me, I'm now joined by a panel of top experts. David Alan Green, a law and policy expert and contributing editor to the Financial Times. Professor Michael Keating, Director of the Centre on Constitutional Change at Edinburgh University. Professor Meg Russell, Director of the Constitution Unit at University College London, and Professor Murray Hunt, Director of the Bingham Centre for the Rule of Law. So here we are, convening the Aronovich Commission on the British Constitution. And the first question I want to ask is, where has the Supreme Court judgment left us in terms of the Constitution? Meg Russell.
I think it'd be worthwhile reflecting a little bit how we got to this point, some things that we might come back to later. How did we get into this kind of mess between Parliament and government? We're living under the shadow of a referendum, which is quite an unusual thing in the British Constitution. A referendum on a question which divides both of the main political parties and which came up with an answer which was contrary to the beliefs of what was the right outcome for most MPs. And MPs have been left to sort it out. So that's kind of where the tension begins with a constitutional issue in terms of a referendum. The arrival of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister has also put under enormous pressure another key bit of our constitution in terms of the extent to which we rely on conventions. And the conventions demand, really, in terms of things like the prorogation of Parliament, that those in key positions within the system respect tradition and the ways that things have conventionally been done. And Boris Johnson chose to just tear that up and shut Parliament down for 5 weeks. So that brings in a rather unfamiliar bit of the system, that is the judges, who normally in British politics wouldn't have that much power because we don't have a written constitution which sits above all other law. That kind of system puts the judges in a powerful position. Because we have a political constitution, the judges aren't normally involved. There was a big argument about whether they could be involved. And the judgment was that it was perfectly proper for them to rule on whether what the Prime Minister had done was right, and they ruled that what he'd done was wrong. Some people are presenting that as a revolution. I don't think it is at all, because I think what the judges actually did was step in to protect and, in a way, to resurrect the political constitution. They put Parliament back into the centre of things, and I think that was the right thing to do.
Michael Keating.
I think it really is very significant. The Supreme Court has not been functioning as a constitutional court. It's tended to stick to the black letter of the law. So, for example, in relation to devolution, it ruled a couple of years ago in the first Miller case that the Sewell Convention...
That's the first case that Gina Miller took.
That's right, over Article 50. But, by the way, they said in relation to the Legislative Consent Convention, that is, that the UK Parliament will not legislate in devolved matters without the consent of the devolved administrations. They said that that convention was just a political convention and was to be utterly dismissed. It caused a great deal of dismay in Scotland and Wales, where we thought it was one of the conventions that were binding in the Constitution. This time around, it said, well, constitutions do matter. It's talked about the fact that we have got a constitution with a capital C. It does include conventions. It does include precedent and practices. They talked about the separation of powers, which is bringing back an old idea that hasn't been around for a long time, that there's got to be a balance between Parliament and government, and the Supreme Court will police that balance. They even made a reference to the referendum. They said they're not permitted to consider the merits of Brexit because the people have decided that, not because Parliament have decided that. So they've opened up an awful lot of issues that are going to continue to be around. And this was inevitable. This was bound to happen at some point because the Constitution has been under an awful lot of strain in recent years.
OK, I want to come to that, the question of strain, in a minute. But David Alan Green, what do you think has altered as a result of the judgment?
A starting point, I think, to talk about constitutions is actually have a clear idea in your head what is a constitution, what is it for. A constitution does two things. First of all, it provides for which element of the state can do what, who can legislate, who can adjudicate, who can carry out its executive powers. And then it should provide for what happens when there's a tension between any of those elements of the state and resolve that tension before it hardens into a contradiction. The problem the British constitution has is that a great deal of the arrangements for what each element of the state does and how tensions are resolved is not set out in black letter law. And even less
Sorry,
of
what
that...
What is black letter law?
Black letter law. It's not set out in statutes. It's not set out anywhere. It's in books of conventions, case law. Very little of it is actually in something you would say a legal instrument. And of the stuff which is in the legal instrument, very little of that is set out in Acts of Parliament. Almost entire parts of the Constitution work on the basis of convention. So when you have a conflict between elements of a state, people know what to do to resolve it. When you have a number 10 operation, such as we seem to have at the moment, where conventions are seen as opportunities to get away with things, what can you do? And it does seem to me that one thing which has come out of this case is that the Supreme Court have said, this area, we are now putting a test, a public law test of reasonableness in, because it now needs to be put on a more solid legal basis.
Murray Hunt, do you also see that the role of the Supreme Court has been altered by this? I mean, and the way in which David Alan Green puts it is they've had to take unto themselves, or have taken unto themselves, the role of policing convention.
I don't see it as an alteration of their role. I think it's an extremely significant judgment. It really does reassert the supremacy of Parliament over the executive. What's new
exactly.
is that the
it doesn't,
Supreme Court...
It doesn't enforce the supremacy of the judges. That's kind of my key point. That if they're policing a convention, but at the heart of this case, what the case was about was the body which ought to be at the centre of the Constitution having been set down. Often the judges will defer to Parliament. Hmm. They couldn't defer to Parliament in this case because Parliament had been stymied.
I think that's right. As in the first Miller case as well, this was a case of the courts being invited in to uphold parliamentary supremacy over the executive. So we're often used to arguing about parliamentary sovereignty in the relationship between the courts and Parliament. But this litigation was about the relationship between Parliament and the executive. And a really important feature of our constitutional arrangements is that in a parliamentary democracy committed to the rule of law, Parliament is supreme over the executive. The executive doesn't have unlimited, unbridled power, including the power to just get Parliament out of the way. And the way I see the judgment is that it's a reassertion of that incredibly important principle, which is embedded in our constitution. And it's not revolutionary. I agree with Meg. It isn't revolutionary or a significant alteration of its role, because that's an ancient principle in our constitution. That's what the constitutional upheavals in the 17th century were about. But this time, the big confrontation between Parliament and the executive has been settled by civil law, not civil war.
So I want to ask any of you wants to take this on, really, who has come out on top in all this, or is it too early to tell?
Well, one innovatory thing about this judgment, it seems to me, isn't the substance. I agree on the substance. It is a reassertion of things. But its form, it is explicitly a constitutional judgment. If you go back through case law, you sometimes can read an entire case, like, say, Padfield, where you can go through pages and pages and not realise it's so significant as a constitutional case.
I have no idea what Padfield is.
Padfield's a case about a milk marketing board, which is actually one of the leading cases of the British Constitution. But you wouldn't know it by reading it. But this judgment was openly, unflinchingly a constitutional judgment and intended to be seen as such. So I think that is a novelty of the court, actually writing out its judgments, knowing its constitutional role, in such an explicit way.
So I guess what I want to ask you, or any of you wants to answer this one, is has anything that's happened in the business of this Supreme Court coming to its judgment that's actually changed your view of what the Constitution is or where it's going?
I think it's clarified the important role of the Supreme Court as holding the ring in these institutional relations between our branches of government. And that's an extremely important and significant thing for it to have done. I don't think, in terms of where we go now, it hasn't, of course, settled those questions. As we've seen yesterday, the Prime Minister himself has suggested in the Commons that the Supreme Court's decision was wrong. And he hasn't just said that the decision, the outcome of the decision was wrong. He's said that the court was wrong to enter on the question. He disagrees that this was a justiciable question, one the courts should decide. So this issue continues to be contested by our constitutional actors. So this is a step along the way in our constitutional process.
Sorry, can you clarify it? How can he contest it if it's the law?
Well, he hasn't contested it in the sense of not complying with the declaration that they gave. He hasn't refused to turn up when Parliament reconvened. But he has in Parliament said that he thinks the decision is wrong. And so it's clear that there is an ongoing legitimacy debate going on about the role of the court.
So actually, that kind of suggests that as Prime Minister, he might seek to bring back legislation that changes him. We'll come to that a bit later.
I think there is something shocking about this whole episode, which makes you reevaluate the Constitution in ways which we'll probably come on to. But the thing that was shocking was not the behaviour of the court, it was the behaviour of the Prime Minister, which precipitated the need for the court to intervene. It was the fact that the Prime Minister ignored conventions that most people would have accepted. And that makes our constitution, our unwritten constitution based on historical precedent and convention, suddenly look fragile because we never thought we would have people in positions of power who were prepared to flout it to that extent.
Now, one thing I want to ask, because it struck me during the course of this whole debate, is if the Queen always has to do, or the monarch always has to do what the Prime Minister says, then what's the point of them?
David Ann Green. Historically, the Crown was more significant for what power it prevented other people having than for what the power of the Crown had itself directly. There was always this residual power of the monarch to do things in exceptional circumstances. We all now know that that is a fiction, and essentially the monarch will do whatever is requested of them by the Prime Minister. And this is what something which this judgment takes on squarely. The role of Prime Minister hardly exists formally in the British Constitution. It's always been primus inter pares. It's always first amongst equals, just happens to be the chair of the cabinet. The role has never really been looked at carefully by the courts. This judgment changes that. This judgment said that the Prime Minister no longer can just act in the selfish interests of the government in seeking exercise of prerogative powers. The Prime Minister has a constitutional role now and has to take account of the constitutional implications of the decisions. That is the Supreme Court coming in and noticing this gap where the monarch should be and saying, well, if you're going to be advising the Crown, you've got to look at things in the round as well. You can't just keep on looking at it in a selfish way.
Sorry to sound like an idiot on this, but in other places, and we'll come on to what other places do a bit more later, you'd have a head of state who would actually have a little bit more power and would have powers in their own right and wouldn't necessarily have to do what the Prime Minister says. But we have a head of state who, because they're a hereditary monarch, can't do anything but what the Prime Minister says. So I go back to it, Murray Hunt, what's the point of it?
I think it's a very good question. There's a very interesting observation by Stephen Sedley in the London Review of Books recently.
Who is?
Stephen Sedley, former Court of Appeal judge. And he points out that we very quickly describe our system as a representative democracy, whereas in fact we're not. We're a constitutional monarchy. And I think that what the judgment exposes is that we have actually made the journey to being a proper representative democracy, but we haven't addressed the formal questions around that. So we don't anymore defend a substantive role for the monarch in a constitutional monarchy. We are really a representative democracy, which comes on to the question I know you want to discuss about whether it's time to look again at our constitutional arrangements and whether they reflect our current reality.
I do. I want first to look at one or two of the other strains which we referred to earlier. And Meg Russell particularly, people have talked about the new dynamic that has also entered in with the simple fact of the referendum itself, the use of the referendum. We didn't used to have them, but increasingly we do. Now, firstly, very quickly, why do we increasingly have them?
I think partly it's to do with maybe some decline in trust or faith in our representative institutions. But I think that what we've seen, yes, we haven't had very many of them. Their use is actually on the increase all around the world, which I think is about a kind of anti-political sentiment and a not wanting to trust politicians in general and feeling that decisions need to go direct to the people. But the way that we've used them in the UK, they've all been on constitutional matters. And some of them have been used, I think, very sensibly in a way that kind of bolsters our political constitution, because the nature of the political constitution is you do not have a document which serves as higher law. So any law in principle can be changed by Parliament at any time, and judges can't step in and stop people changing the law. If that's what Parliament wants, it will happen within the constraints of international law and so on. So when we had devolution, for example, the referendums in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland served as a kind of bolstering to the decisions taken by Parliament. You talk about legal entrenchment of constitutions, which is this sense of higher law. What those referendums offered was a kind of political entrenchment that would make it difficult for a future Parliament to simply overturn things like the devolution settlement without going back to the people and asking for their consent. And I think that is a very sensible and stabilising use of referendums. The EU referendum was very different to that. It was on a matter which Parliament did not wish to see enacted. Previous ones, you know, Parliament wanted to legislate for devolution in Scotland. It asked the Scottish people whether they were OK with that.
Sorry to interrupt. I'm trying to understand this. Are you saying that it was more difficult because if you'd wanted to do it properly, Parliament would have come forward and said, here's a deal we've negotiated with the European Union for our withdrawal. Do you want this, or do you want the status quo? Is that what you're saying?
Kind of. I mean, it's a bit complicated because of the need for negotiation in terms of our relationship with Europe. But if you look at the way that referendums are used in constitutions around the world, it's very common for there to be a requirement that constitutional change requires approval in a referendum. But the standard process, you look at places like Australia, Italy, Japan, all around the world, is there's a multi-stage process where the change has to be agreed by Parliament and agreed in a referendum. So you're not giving the people a power over Parliament to veto what Parliament wants. You're asking them to endorse what Parliament has decided, and you need the agreement of both. What we did was hold a referendum on a change that Parliament didn't want to make. It was called by the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee in the House of Commons, which is importantly chaired by a Brexiteer, Bernard Jenkin. It was called a bluff call referendum. It was David Cameron going to the country in order to try and take an issue off the political agenda. One of the things that happens with referendums is they do tend around the world to be used as an opportunity to kick politicians in the teeth. And that's what happened, and we're left with the consequences.
David Alan Green, that kind of suggests that the only useful referendum is one which Parliament already knows the result it wants of and gets it.
Well, the fundamental problem with referendums in the United Kingdom is the concept of mandate. Usually, with general elections, mandates have very weak purchase. But in 1987, the Conservatives clearly promised a change to the poll tax. They reversed that within 3 years, and nobody said, oh, the government's got to carry out its commitment, because obviously in practice the poll tax was a disaster. This referendum injected something into the body politic which has caused an immense amount of instability, and that is because it has a mandate which is almost impossible to gainsay. It can only be discharged, or it perhaps could be extinguished by another referendum. But whilst it's there, there's nothing Parliament can do against the mandate because the mandate has come from another source.
So I see what you're saying. You can say, here's what was in my manifesto, but actually circumstances have changed. And providing people were agreeing with you broadly about that change, nobody would bother about it. They're only going to get cross about it if the manifesto was something they really wanted to happen.
And I don't think the UK system can cope easily with these injections of mandate by referendum into a system which otherwise has a parliamentary system, because how do you deal with that? Referendums can either be democratic or they can be irrevocable. But it should be open to people to be able to vote again to extinguish this mandate. Because I can't see any other way of getting rid of this mandate other than actually carrying it out.
Michael Keating, this must be very interesting for you sitting up in Edinburgh, not least because you had a referendum on Scottish independence yourself in 2014, the power for which was given, wasn't it, by the British Parliament to the Scottish people in a negotiation with the devolved Scottish government, presumably by nothing more substantial than a decision by the British Parliament that it should.
That's right. The order was to transfer power temporarily to the Scottish Parliament. It solved the independence question for a few months. It's back on the agenda. The other thing about referendums, of course, is they answer a simple answer to a very complex question. Well, they polarise opinions. They say it's either A or B. What was interesting after the Scottish referendum, though, was when the Remain in the UK option had won by 55%, the winners reached out to the losers and there was a compromise. There was a bill which reflected where public opinion actually was, which was somewhere between those two options. We've had nothing like that after the Brexit referendum. The interpretation of a 52% mandate to leave has been taken to mean leave, even an extreme leave, with no deal and with no future relationship.
So that's a very good example where a political decision has constitutional ramifications. In other words, it's important to try and decide where the people are at any particular time constitutionally and not just a majority of the people. So that brings me to my next question. What if there was a populist government with a big majority? Not at all impossible. What would stop it, under our constitution, legislating away rights that the majority found unpopular but which protected significant sections of the population? Or interfered, let's say, with the independence of the judiciary? Murray.
Under our current constitutional arrangements, I think there would be concern that there aren't very strong and robust limits to a government which has a clear Commons majority and a clear popular mandate to do such things. There are some constraints. We are still the member of international treaties, such as the European Convention on Human Rights and other human rights treaties. And those treaties do have some legal effect under the Human Rights Act, but that itself may well be up for grabs with such a government as you describe. And I think that is one of the questions which is left hanging by the Supreme Court's decision. The Supreme Court has made a very clear assertion about Parliament's supremacy over the executive, but it hasn't addressed the question of what happens if we have an executive with a clear popular mandate and a majority in Parliament and normal services resumed. Normal services that the government channels the will of the people through its Commons majority.
Yes, I would say that the Supreme Court judgment has been very useful in showing that we do have a last line of protection against an executive that goes rogue. But if we had a parliament that went rogue, I'm not sure that those protections
David Allen Green, the will of the people, it gets talked about an awful lot and people invoke it in all kinds of ways. Should a constitution take account of the will of the people?
If Dr. Samuel Johnson was alive today, he would say that it wasn't patriotism which was the less refuge of a scoundrel, it was the will of the people. It's usually prayed in aid by charlatans. If we had such a populist government, yes, we've got the ECHR, the courts are trying...
European Courts of Human Rights.
But the UK courts are trying to develop the concept of constitutional rights, like access to a court. So even if we left the ECHR, there will be some judges who would actually try and hold fundamental rights in the face of such a populist government. But if you've got this will of the people through parliamentary elections, then there's very little that can be done. The problem with this referendum result is that it's pitting the will of the people against Parliament rather than through it. But if you did have a populist, authoritarian, nationalist government with a parliamentary majority...
Or socialist.
But it would be very difficult to hold against it, although it wouldn't be completely futile.
The courts do have a lot of resources. Another important principle of our constitution is the rule of law. There's a slightly interesting paradox about the Supreme Court's judgment, which is that everyone regards this as being one of the most important rule of law judgments the Supreme Court has ever made, and yet the rule of law is not mentioned once in the judgments. And that's a curious paradox, but I think it reflects a nervousness on the part of the courts that they think the rule of law sounds like it's the rule of lawyers. And what we need to do, I think, is to make it clear that the rule of law is something which is the responsibility of all our branches, not just the courts.
Right, we've talked about where the judgment has left us, and we've talked about some of the strains that the Constitution is under and things, some things that we've learned. Now, people are making suggestions as a consequence of the ruling, quite a few, some of them actually from the government, that judges should be politically vetted as in the US, that we should revert to having the law lords rather than the Supreme Court. Those come from cabinet sources. What do we make of the suggestions that have been made so far that take account of the Supreme Court decision in constitutional terms?
Well, those suggestions from cabinet sources are daft. The government's in the weakest possible position to force through any fundamental change with a minority of 40-odd in Commons. And it's a dreadful thing which certain politicians do, is when you have a political defeat or some sort of setback, you want to change the rules of the game. When David Cameron lost a vote in the House of Lords, he threatened fundamental House of Lords reform. When he lost a decision on prisoners' rights, he was thinking about taking us out of the ECHR. This knee-jerk reaction of let's have fundamental constitutional change because there's something we don't like is a very worrying thing.
Michael Keating, one of the points that was made earlier by Philip Norton was that actually we do tend to have big constitutional discussions in light of political decisions that have gone in a way that people don't like. And I took from that, though he didn't say it, that without those moments we probably wouldn't get any constitutional change.
Well, that's exactly right. We get constitutional change at moments of crisis. We never get it because people have sat down and thought out the consequence of it. We get it because a question has to be resolved. This happened in the earlier part of the 20th century with the House of Lords, the women's suffrage, and a whole series of issues. But that doesn't mean we can just continue muddling through because we've got so many problems on our plate at the moment that some of this really has to be clarified.
Okay, let's move on to the big questions always raised about the Constitution, about what should we do, is whether we should have, like the Americans, a written Constitution. Now, one of the little things I did before we came on air was just to find out what had happened in the case of, let's say, Canada or Australia when they became independent. Had they taken our common law and then adopted it and not had a written constitution? And they'd all gone for written constitutions. So the first question I want to ask all of you is, should we have a written constitution? Meg Russell.
I find it very difficult on this question to separate the should we questions from the can we questions. There are principled positions on this and there are pragmatic positions on this. And of course, pragmatic is the way that we usually go in the UK, but there's no point calling for something if it can't happen. And I frankly cannot see the steps, unless we're going to face some kind of serious disaster in the months and years ahead, by which we would achieve a fully written constitution. Because if you're going to write everything down, it requires you to agree on all of the separate bits of the constitution. So, you know, we've mentioned devolution. It requires you to agree on what the relationship is between London and the devolved bodies. We've mentioned the House of Lords. It requires you to say, what size should it be? What power should it have? Should it be elected or appointed? You know, we are never going to get agreement on a package that contains all of these issues. So I don't think, you know, when you look at places like Canada and Australia that you mentioned, and you look across continental Europe, how do you get a written constitution? It generally is after a kind of complete collapse or reinvention of the system. Okay. As you say, independence, defeat in war, revolution, a complete meltdown of some kind. I hope we're not going to have one of those. And if we're not going to have one of those, I think it's more piecemeal, pragmatic solutions to fill some of the gaps that have been identified. That's the more likely route.
Let's come to some of those in a moment. And I like the kind of recipe nature of this. First, have a revolution, then have a written constitution. But, David, how do you see this?
Well, part of the problem is that we do have a written constitution. It's just not written down in one place. It's all in various texts. We just don't have a codified constitution. And on that question, I'm afraid neutrality is a sensible position, because codified constitutions are not necessarily liberal, nice things. Very dreadful, illiberal things can happen. A codified constitution can entrench state power, make it more difficult to actually check and balance what the government wants to get away with. So unless and until you can show in detail how a codified constitution would actually be better than the current arrangements, then I'm afraid you cannot see it as something which is necessarily a positive thing.
Michael, is that the way you see it? I mean, I took the implication from the way you've been talking that actually it would be a good idea to try and get as much of it kind of written down and properly agreed and codified as possible, because the current system leaves us rather vulnerable.
Well, not exactly. I'm largely with Meg on this. I think you'd have to have agreement on too many things to make this possible. And we'd have to try and agree on the basic foundations of the constitution. Now, if you look even at one little bit of our constitution, which is Northern Ireland, they do have written arrangements that are entrenched in domestic law and international law. They're full of deliberate fudges. They leave in abeyance the question of sovereignty, who really is control. That's to manage a very complicated problem. And I think there's something quite creative about that deliberate ambiguity. The other problem is, of course, if you try and get a written constitution right now, you're freezing things that might evolve over time. Who would have thought 20 years ago you'd have to have a clause about whether Scotland could become independent or not? That is now an issue that has to be addressed. So I'm not in favour of the big bang, let's get a written constitution immediately, or imagining that we could ever agree upon one. I lived in Canada for a long time, and they spend all that time. They've been talking since 1867 about agreeing the constitution. They still haven't got there. But what is important, and Canadian experience is relevant now, there is that certain things have got to be clarified. Certain things have got to be put into law and are being put into law. And we need to clarify what the role of conventions is, as opposed just to the strict letter of the law. We need to be able to engage in some kind of constitutional politics, constitutional reasoning, and saying that there is a difference between things being written down in hard law and things being part of the constitution, but that doesn't mean it's all to do with politics. I think we're actually getting there, and I think until Brexit we made a huge amount of progress in understanding the nature of the constitution. But Brexit has just reopened all these questions all over again, including the Scottish independence question and the status of Northern Ireland.
Murray Hunt.
Personally, I think the written constitution question is a red herring. I agree with my colleagues that we have a written constitution to some extent. We have a partially written constitution. The process of arriving at a fully written constitution is very hard to imagine, especially starting from the polarised position at which we begin. I prefer to see constitutional reform as being a continual process of change, and it accelerates at certain periods of history. And I think we are at the point now where we need an accelerated process of change, but we need to identify, as Meg says, what are the priority questions that we need to address and to reform.
OK, well, let's do that then. We don't like a written constitution. None of you do. But you do want to see some reforms which will help us. And I still think that out there is the question of how you protect the conventions which there are if people aren't going to abide by them. So let's go for the question of what could be changed in a reasonable length of time. Meg, you first.
OK. Well, I think I'd approach that in two ways. One in terms of the substance, and another in terms of the process, which I think is really important and is something that we haven't discussed yet. We've heard about how part of the cause of the current instability that we have is the fact that we have minority government. We're not used to that. And we don't seem to be very good at managing it. We clearly need now, I think, to nail down some of these conventions, such as the power to prorogue. That needs to be handed to Parliament itself to decide decide whether it wishes to be prorogued. It can now decide whether it wishes to be dissolved for a general election, whether it wants to go into recess, but the power of prorogation lies still with the executive. So there are small loopholes like that. I think within Parliament itself, there's some really serious thinking to be done as to who has access to the parliamentary agenda, because in this period of minority government, we've seen backbenchers fighting to get things onto the agenda. Actually, if they're a majority, they should be able to get agenda access. The government has too much control of the agenda in Parliament. But in terms of process, I don't think this should just be top-down stuff. I think, you know, we're going through a very difficult period in British politics. We need to start bringing people together. We need to start including the public in discussions about what kind of politics, what kind of institutions we want in this country. And constitution making is often done through things like citizens' assemblies and so on, which bring people together to deliberate on these big, difficult questions. And I think we're going to need some of that, but more on the detail than on the whole shebang.
Michael Keating, where would you start?
I would think about limiting the prerogative power, writing that down, subjecting it more completely to parliamentary control. A lot of that has been done. We need to think about the role of Parliament. We can't avoid thinking about the electoral system. I know that's not strictly a constitutional question, but if we go for electoral reform, proportional representation, we will no longer have majority governments. That opens up the whole question of Parliament and empowers Parliament. I think we need to think about the devolution settlement. We've got a quasi-federal system, but the ultimate power remains with Westminster. We have all kinds of conventions and rules about devolution, but there's nothing to stop the UK Parliament and therefore the UK government overruling the devolved legislatures under almost all circumstances. We need to think about rights and how the European Convention on Human Rights, assuming we're going to stay within that because that's not part of the EU, how that relates to the UK. These rights are directly enforceable under Scottish and Welsh and Northern Ireland law. In England, it's really pretty muddled. And we need to think about the role of the head of state. We need to think about some kind of constitutional referee here who is able to intervene in these cases. And then we need to think about the Supreme Court as a constitutional court and admit that it is a constitutional court, not just an ordinary court enforcing the letter of the law. The judgment this week, I think, is an opening to think about the role of the Supreme Court as an arbiter in a system which power is dispersed and not simply concentrated in one place.
David Allen Green, what would be your top priority for change?
There needs to be a what I would call a Johnson-Cummings test applied to every single convention, every single prerogative power. Can this be abused? And if so, how can it be checked and balanced? And we also need to place as much as possible on a statutory basis. It should not be left to waiting for the Supreme Court to decide. Before the Supreme Court came in, nobody expected an 11-0 decision. It was could have gone either way. It was too close to call, according to most commentators, including myself. Now it looks very obvious in hindsight. So we shouldn't be waiting for Supreme Court judgments. We should have it on a statutory basis. Constitutions are there to set out the parameters of political action. Constitutional law at the moment in the UK is exciting. It is not a good thing for constitutional law to be exciting.
Murray Hunt, your top two?
Top two priorities would be Parliament's control over prerogative powers. The prorogation case has really put that in the spotlight now, and I think it needs to be looked at generally across the prerogative powers. Secondly, how we deal with the rights that are going to be lost as a result of Brexit in terms of human rights and equality. But the top priority, which I appreciate is three, is the process question that Meg has raised quite rightly. I would say we need to address that first. How are we going to go about constitutional reform? Let's have a speakers' conference on the process by which we actually address these questions.
A speaker's conference, not a royal commission.
I would prefer Parliament to be at the heart of it. And the attraction of the speaker's conference proposal, which the speaker recently made, is that that puts Parliament in the driving seat.
So a speaker's conference, which also uses citizens' assemblies to consult about the constitution. Is that where we've ended up?
I would be in favour of exploring the possibility of citizens' assemblies, feeding into then Parliament's consideration.
I agree.
And at that point, I think we can say we've done our job. Meg Russell there with David Allen Green, Murray Hunt and Michael Keating. My thanks to them and to Philip Norton and Alison Young. And their conclusion was, as I think you heard, there is a need for constitutional change and safeguarding, and the best way to begin that process would be a speakers' conference of the House of Commons with the help of citizens' assemblies. Let's see if anyone in power is listening. We'll be back at the same time next week. Until then, good night. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Neil Koenig and Serena Tarling. The studio managers were Neil Churchill and Tom Brignall. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.